Tom Woods Show, episode 2280.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, the Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, chances are, if you're listening to this podcast, you are surrounded by irrational, panicked people who think you're a terrible person because you don't want to lock everybody in their houses. No amount of reasoning appears to accomplish anything. And not to mention the media has done nothing but stoke fear and fail to provide context. Well, one of the many benefits you get as a supporter of The Tom Woods Show is membership inside The Tom Woods Show Elite. Recently migrated off Facebook, so if that was holding you back, no longer. This group will keep you sane and informed, and as an added bonus, it won't accuse you of wanting to kill your grandmother. Join me in there at supportinglisteners.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Our old friend Martin Kulldorff, professor at Harvard Medical School, on leave at the moment, is back with us. And we're talking about a really, really important document that he and seven colleagues drafted in advance of any kind of COVID hearing that might take place. These are some questions that people might be asked. And my goodness, would it be enlightening to get the answers to these questions. Martin, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Tom. It's a great pleasure.
Now, am I describing the circumstances right? You and these colleagues drafted this document in the hope that it might in some way influence the subsequent discussion potentially in Washington about the COVID response?
Exactly. So there are a lot of things that were drawn with our approach to COVID. And the eight of us thought we should write down some of the key questions that should be asked to those who were in charge of the COVID strategy. People like Anthony Fauci, Rochelle Walensky, Red Westfield, the former CDC director, the NIH directors, and also politicians who were in charge, as well as leading scientists, why they got so many things wrong. So we sort of were listing that questions, some detailed and some more general, and not just for the U.S., for other countries as well.
And the questions themselves have hyperlinks inside them, taking you sometimes to studies and various sources that are relevant in this matter and backing up what you're saying. Is this document available to be read anywhere? You sent me a PDF, but is there anywhere I can find it online?
Yeah, so it's available for free to anybody. People are free to distribute it further also. There's no copyright on it in that sense. So it's at www.norfolkgroup.org. So that's N-O-R-F-O-L-K group, one word, .org. We met in a small town called Norfolk, Connecticut the first time. That was back in May, almost a year ago now. And then we've been working on it through the months since, summer and fall.
Just out of curiosity, how many of the seven other people had you known personally before this whole crisis occurred?
Before the COVID crisis?
Yes. Had you known any of them?
No.
So these are all people you've gotten to know as a result of what happened since 2020?
Yeah, it's all scientists, public health scientists, who have spoken up about the problems and sort of read carefully the various studies and then drawn the conclusions based on the scientific studies rather than based on what narrative was wanted by the government or others people.
Have any of your views on any aspect of this question changed or evolved over the past few years, whether it's masks or any of this? Is there anything that maybe you thought might have worked a little bit and even that didn't work either? Or has your opinion pretty much been the same on all these things throughout?
Well, on the therapeutics and the vaccines, I mean, in the beginning, we didn't know. We didn't know what would or would not work. So obviously, once more and more information comes in, then one knows more. And one has to, I think, as scientists, one always has to recognize that at some point, we don't know certain things. We don't know if a certain drug is going to work against COVID or not. And then we try it out in a clinical trial. And then we find out it worked or it didn't work.
Well, there's so many areas we could jump around in. I sent an email to my newsletter list the other day in which I pulled out some of what I thought were some of the more provocative questions. But even then, I could barely scratch the surface. I mean, this is 80 pages long, but the substance of it is like some 400-page books. I mean, because it's a series of questions, there's no fluff in it at all. It's all crucial information. And of course, you can tell from the way the questions are phrased, you know, that it would be hard for them to answer. Did they consider this potential bit of collateral damage from the lockdowns? Well, you know, they didn't. You know, we all kind of know that the answer is no, they didn't, because they were either panicked or some of them were power hungry. I don't know, but I'm sure with some of the questions relating to the collateral lockdown harms that the answer is simply no, sorry, we didn't. But of course, they can't give that answer. So I wonder what answer they would give.
I wonder too. And I hope sometimes somebody would ask them the question and I will find out.
And that's just it, is that if we lived in a healthy society, the kinds of questions that just jump off the page in this document would have been asked regularly throughout this thing. But instead, if you so much as raised this, there were platforms where you were risking being removed or censured in some way or suppressed just for asking. We don't even get the answer, but just for asking them.
No, that's true. I was myself censored on both the Twitter, LinkedIn, and the YouTube. And I had to self-censor myself because I didn't want to be suspended. I wanted to be able to continue to speak out. So I had to do self-censoring.
I presume you feel a bit more comfortable on Twitter now?
On Twitter, yes. I feel I can pretty much say what I want on Twitter. So that's good.
That's something. That's something.
I still have to be careful on LinkedIn.
Yeah, LinkedIn I've never tried to struggle with. So my sympathies to you there. The first question in here that I reproduced in my newsletter was, why was so much influence on public health policy accorded to Drs. Collins and Fauci? They control the largest source of infectious disease research funding in the world. How many infectious disease scientists who should have been strong voices during the pandemic kept quiet for fear of losing the research funding on which their livelihood depends? Dr. Bhattacharya had the same concern, and he's expressed it on this program. And I asked him about it, and I would rather suspect that back in, say, 2019, yes, I'm sure he knew that Fauci and Collins controlled all this money, but I don't think he really gave it much thought as to what influence it might have on public health research. Are you the same way? Is this suddenly a concern that maybe wasn't on your radar before?
Yes, that's true. And I think that's been a big problem during the pandemic. And I think there's two problems. One is just the fact that NIH and NID are research organizations. Their role during a pandemic or any public health emergency is to fund the necessary research that is needed. For example, they could have funded a randomized mass study in schools to see the efficacy of mass, if it's zero or something. They didn't do many of those studies that should have been done. On the other hand, to do the policy, that's not their job. And I think it's dangerous to mix the research portfolio with the policy, because then the scientists who want to speak up won't dare to speak up because they're contradicting the people who's giving them money. So the policy, that's the role of the CDC and the CDC director. So they should have been in charge of the policy, while NIH and NID should have focused on generating the knowledge as quickly as possible that was needed to make decisions about this pandemic. So I think the NIH and NID, Collins and Fauci, they failed on that.
Do you think health professionals, whether in public health or otherwise, have softened in their views on the necessity of lockdowns over the past few years? I'm sure there are some who are exactly the same as they were in March 2020. But do you think some have started at least now to concede that the collateral damage is much higher than maybe they thought it would be?
I think so. Even if they don't do it in public, I think privately or silently, they realize more and more what a disaster these lockdowns were and the collateral public health harm on other aspects of public health, like cancer or cardiovascular disease, mental health, diabetes care, and so on. Because those things, they don't necessarily, like the cancer thing doesn't show up within a few weeks or months, like infectious diseases do. But somebody who would have died, who would have survived 15, 20 years, might not die of cervical cancer 3 years from now because they didn't get the right screening. So I think that public health is waking up to that. There's really no choice because they're going to see the data. But I think most of them are still very silent about it.
Now, as an epidemiologist yourself, you may have had something to do with looking at sort of the executive summary here. I'm looking at item number 6. You might have had something to do with composing the material in item number 6, but why was there so much emphasis, the question reads, and trust in complex epidemiological models which are by nature unreliable during the middle of an epidemic, with unknown input parameters and questionable assumptions. So this goes to, I suppose, the limits of your field. So can you talk to us about that? As I look at it, as we emerge from this nightmare of the past 3 years, I'm shocked at how many epidemiologists seem to be, let me just be blunt with you, Martin, they seem to be crazy people. They seem to be incapable of balancing risk and cost and benefit. And not to mention, I think it was the New York Times that did polls of a small sampling of professional epidemiologists, and a surprising percentage of them, even late in this crisis, were still hesitant to go out and get the mail, like they're going to get COVID touching their mail. There's something odd about this profession, Martin, and you seem to be one of the normal ones.
Well, I never was scared of getting my mail.
Good.
I guess I was maybe scared of getting too many bills or whatever, but not for the anything with the infections.
So in other words, like what can we reasonably expect from epidemiology? And what can't we? I mean, in a way, it's like meteorology. I would have the same question. By and large, I can learn about the weather for the most part, but it's not always right. They have real trouble tracking hurricanes until like the last minute, but yet at least I know there's a hurricane coming. So I have a kind of sense of what meteorology can tell me and what's too much to ask. What do we say this likewise for epidemiology?
Yeah, so with the weather, I mean, we can talk, if they say they're going to be sunny or rainy or snowy 3 weeks from now, we can't trust that because you can't predict that far in advance. And when it comes to epidemiological modeling is sort of a small subfield within epidemiology. And one thing they try to do is to predict how many COVID cases or influenza cases or something is going to be in the future. And I think that has the same challenges as the weathermen have had. You can't rely on those models for future prediction. But I think they wanted to shine, that this was their moment, and they came up with all kinds of predictions, and then obviously turned out to be wrong, most of them. And then the media was interested, so they went with it. So it was all crazy in terms of those predictions. Now, ethnological modeling can be used for other things. For example, we want to know how many has already been infected. And that we can do, sample, a random sample of people. So Jay Bhattacharya did that, the first big study in the US, the Santa Clara study. In the early 2020, they sampled the people, and then they found out how many people had antibodies to find out how many had already been infected. And then you can use that to estimate how dangerous it is, what is the infection fatality rate, it is among people who have the infection, how many people died. And I did some calculations also in March of 2020 based on the early data from Wuhan, and it was clear that there was a 1,000-fold difference between in risk of mortality from COVID between the older and the younger. So those kind of estimates can be done, and they are very important because we need to know who to protect and who not to protect. But instead, a lot of the modelers were focusing, is putting some wild assumption in, and then they were having very complex, sophisticated models to find out how many people would die in the UK or in the US under different scenarios. And that's not very helpful. And I think they did an enormous disservice to public health by doing those unreliable models.
Can you talk for a minute about contact tracing? Because so many people in public health urged contact tracing as a way of containing the spread. And in this piece of yours, we read the following question. Why did federal and state governments spend large amounts of effort and money on futile testing and contact tracing activities? What is the source of the futility?
So it depends on what kind of infectious disease it is. So we had some years ago some Ebola cases in the US. And Ebola is a very dangerous disease. And for such a disease, it's actually good to see, okay, this person had Ebola. We want to check all the person they interacted with and test them to see if they also have Ebola, because if they do, we want to isolate them so it doesn't spread. So for a disease like Ebola, testing and contact tracing is very important. So it's an important toolbox for epidemiologists. Another example are many sexually transmitted diseases. You have somebody who was infected and you want to check who were their sexual partners and you want to test them as well. So for certain infectious diseases, testing and contact tracing is very important. The problem is for something like COVID or influenza, it's hopeless. because people express very widely people infecting other before they become symptomatic. So it's a hopeless thing to do and just a waste of money. And it seems like people like Anthony Fauci, he's a lab scientist, he's not a public health person. He didn't realize those things. So he thought maybe that, well, it works for one disease, so we can work to use it for every infectious disease, which is not true. So the fact that Anthony Fauci was sort of the leading voice for how to deal with COVID, even though he's a lab scientist instead of knowing things about public health, that was a disaster. And I know there was sort of a private letter that became public from the head of infectious diseases in New York City, where she was begging Fauci to permission to change federal funds from testing and contact tracing to vaccinations instead, because she realized that this contact tracing was useless for COVID.
This document has the table of contents showing 10 different subject areas that are covered. So I want people to understand this is a very, very comprehensive series of questions. I mean, they are the questions that we would want answered in a variety of areas. But I'd like to take a minute to just, again, to give people a sense of the questions. I'd like to just read some of the ones that I pulled out. And there's a bit of a heavy emphasis here on the lockdown issue in particular, only because that's been a particular interest to me, and that's what I've written a lot about. But there's definitely some items here that I'd like to discuss, but I just want to read them. So for example, diabetes care was interrupted during the pandemic. How many Americans did this affect? What will be the long-term consequences, and who will be responsible for defining and collating them? Physical exercise is important for preventing diabetes. How did closing exercise venues such as parks and gyms affect diabetes incidence? What were the effects of COVID-19 restrictions on people with lupus? And then you list a bunch of other issues they might have had. Also, dementia. Why were activities and sports for low-risk young people suspended without considering the harms of isolation and lack of physical activity? Then you talk about percentages of teens feeling sad or hopeless and how that had risen. Why were people discouraged from going out to exercise? Why were gyms closed? Why were sports programs terminated? Then you talk about people gaining weight, which was very significant, average weight of 29 pounds among the 42% of adults who reported gaining weight during the pandemic. Then about the effects on small businesses and the fact that large businesses benefited at their expense. So again, just to give people a sense of how many things are covered. But here's something I'd like to discuss with you for a minute. The question of so-called long COVID. Why is long COVID of greater concern, this is one of your questions, than, for example, long influenza or long norovirus disease? Is it a distinct clinical entity? And then you follow that up with the question, in February 2021, NIH allocated $1.15 billion in funding for long COVID-19 research over a four-year period. Is this a reasonable amount? Historically, how much has NIH spent on research concerning long-term effects after other infectious diseases? I think long COVID came up when I had you on to talk to Eric Topol, but we've had considerable time since then to look at the question further. What's your opinion on long COVID? Is it a real thing? Is it a phantom?
Well, for some people, there are long-term consequences of infections. So that's true for COVID, and it's true for influenza and other infections. So it certainly exists, but I haven't seen any evidence that it is a more serious problem after COVID than after, for example, influenza. So to allocate over $1 billion to this seems a little bit over the top. But maybe we should instead have spend it on long lockdowns, that is the long-term effect of lockdowns, because those, I think, are absolutely enormous and unprecedented.
Hey, folks, quick message from our sponsor, Crowd Health. Every time we make a major life decision, we tend to research it in depth. We don't just marry the first person we meet or buy the first house we visit or apply for the first job that's offered to us. We look into these things. But even though we all know the American healthcare system is completely screwed up, for some reason, a lot of us are just inclined to go with the flow and do what everybody else is doing. But let's face it, the insurance model is broken. Crowd Health has a better way to fund your healthcare costs. You can see any doctor you want, no deductibles, exclusions, or copays. You pay only the first $500 of any healthcare event. The Crowd Health community takes care of the rest. So it's very simple. You pay one low monthly total to fund your account. And that monthly subscription helps fund healthcare costs of the entire Crowd Health community. And this arrangement reverses the vicious incentives that got us into this mess in the first place. And unlike insurance companies, CrowdHealth helps you find great care at a fair price, always pays doctors as quickly as possible, and actively negotiates to keep costs down for everyone. Take charge of your healthcare today with CrowdHealth. And for a limited time, join for just $99 per month for your first 6 months when you go to joincrowdhealth.com/woods. That's joincrowdhealth.com/woods. CrowdHealth is not health insurance. It's a totally different way of paying for healthcare. Terms and conditions may apply. What do you think of all the 10 sections in here? Is there one or two that you think we really especially urgently need the answers to, or that you are especially curious to hear somebody on the hot seat be required to answer?
Well, the second section is about infection-acquired immunity or natural immunity, like immunity after having had COVID. And I'm very curious what people say that, because to me, that's the underlying fundamental flaw in their thinking on many of these other issues. Because many of the high-ranking scientists and government officials was questioning whether there was any natural immunity after infection, which is basically questioning 2,500 years of knowledge about immunology. We've known about natural immunity since the Athenian plague in 430 BC, which, by the way, is about the same amount of time that we've known that the Earth is round rather than flat. So I still can't understand why these things was denied. There was no scientific reasons for it. So maybe they were political or financial or some other reasons. But why would these scientists embarrass themselves by questioning something that has been known for so long? And that misconception or that sort of narrative that you're not immune after having had COVID, that influenced the misguided policy on protecting high-risk Americans, on school closures, on all the collateral public health damage from lockdowns, and also from vaccines, like vaccine mandates, and also testing and contact tracing and so on. So it's really the underlying flaw of then many of these other issues that went so wrong.
I want to talk about the section that I did not, one of the sections I did not cover in my newsletter, public health data and risk communication, because I think it's worth evaluating the kind of guidance and information that we were given, and frankly, the kind that we were not given over the past few years by the public health establishment, in order to assess the real risk involved, who was most likely to contract it. All these types of questions were handled, let's say, not dispassionately or scientifically, but it seemed as if they were handled hysterically. I remember back in the 1980s, there was initially, and I don't know if this was really the lobby involved or the health establishment, but there was for a while an attempt to tell everybody, the mantra was, AIDS is not just a gay disease, with the idea being that everybody's vulnerable to this and everybody has to be on alert about it. But that's not really true. It's only true in the same way that anybody could get struck and killed by a passing horse at the Kentucky Derby. Yeah, that is true. But that won't happen as long as you stay in the stands and don't run out onto the track. And so likewise with the AIDS thing, there was an attempt at the beginning to make everybody feel like, and I think that could have been political because the thinking was the homosexual community in the United States is not really politically thought of very much. So the way we get attention to this is by making everybody feel like they're equally vulnerable. I don't know where that came from, but there definitely was something coming out of public health that seemed to want to suppress the idea that there was an age gradient in mortality, that wanted to make us terrified for our kids. Even now, they're trying to claim that COVID has been a top killer of children. What do you even say about that?
Yeah, so that's the fundamental thing that was not properly communicated, that we had this 1,000-fold difference in risk of dying from COVID, whether you're old or young. Now, a difference from AIDS is that with COVID, anybody can get infected, and most of us will be infected. So it's not the risk of infection that's the issue, it's the risk of serious disease or death. And that's the one that we have a huge age gradient on. And that was a huge failure because as soon as COVID arrived in the country, CDC should have made these studies looking at what is the prevalence, how many people have already had it. Then among those, how many died among different age groups? So CDC should have done that. They did it eventually. I think it was in 2022 that they did that study like that. But that was 2 years too late. So instead, it fell upon individual scientists like Jay Bhattacharya at Stanford, who did the Santa Clara study, and there was another one that he was involved in Los Angeles County that came out a little bit afterwards. So it fell on individual scientists who sort of had to do it on a shoestring budget because they had to scrap through some money here, left or right, because there was no time to apply for money to NIH. So this is a thing that CDC or NIH should have done very rapidly with a random survey covering the whole country, different age groups, to get the basic information about how many has been already been infected and what's the infection fatality rate in different age groups, different populations. Another thing that they missed is that people were reported as COVID death, but some of those people died from COVID due to COVID, but others died with it. They had some other disease and they happened to be infected by COVID at the same time. So there was no CDC should have, or NIH should have done studies to determine of the people who are reported having died of COVID, how many people actually died from COVID. And that didn't happen. Hmm. We still need those numbers.
And from time to time, an article trickles out that seems to indicate that this death figure has been exaggerated to some degree. Now, who knows to what degree, but time and again, we keep seeing indications that, yes, in this particular town or something, we overstated the number of deaths. So that, of course, needs to be investigated. I think in the risk communication section, the most fundamental and devastating question is number one, which is, why was public perception of hospitalization and mortality risk due to COVID-19 so different from the actual risk? And that's true. I know that's also true in the UK. I don't know of other countries. I assume it would be the same, where I think there was a poll done in the UK. There must have been a similar one in the US where they asked people, if you were to develop COVID-19, what are the chances that you would have to be hospitalized? And they asked this, you know, across age groups, and it was, people thought it was like 50-50. They thought there was a 50% chance they'd have to be hospitalized. Or in the UK, I think the result was something like by a factor of 10, they were off in estimating the likelihood of hospitalization. It's not even close. I mean, if they're off by 5%, well, I understand that, but this was shockingly different. So how do we account for that other than either the right information is not coming out or it's not being emphasized? Maybe they did have the age gradient in mortality buried on page 46 in paragraph 7. But if you can see that the public is not absorbing that, then you would have the obligation to place special emphasis on it. And it seems like our officials didn't feel that obligation very strongly.
Yeah, they failed. And even if it's 100% misconception, that's actually okay. That's a twofold difference in risk perception. So if you think it's, you have a 2% risk when the risk is 1%, well, that's not actually too bad. It's the 100%
difference. That's right. That's a good point. Right, right.
But we often had like tenfold differences. People thought, or even more, 20-fold differences. And in the United States, younger people tended to believe that they were at much, much higher risk than they actually have ever been. Older people, they were not as wrong as the younger people with their risk estimates. But with the younger people and for what parents thought of risk for children, they was completely off in terms of mortality from COVID. And I'm saying this like, COVID is a serious disease because for older people, COVID was a major threat and a lot of people died from it. And that was one of the failures that we did not protect older people sufficiently. Everything from sending infected people to nursing home, which is completely crazy. And it's not crazy, it's murder to do that because a lot of older people in this nursing home died because some politician, like the governor of New York, decided to send sick patients into those nursing homes and, of course, then infecting a lot of other patients. So that's a criminal murder. And there was also other things, for example, to tell people that masks will protect them. Well, masks have, we have randomized trials that have shown that masks have zero or very limited ability to prevent infections, the spread of COVID. So to tell older people that put on a mask and then they feel safe going to a crowded restaurant because they're wearing a mask, or they feel safe going to the supermarket because they're wearing masks, when in fact, they don't protect them at all. That's sort of the opposite thing that the public health sent a message that makes people feel safe when they shouldn't feel safe. They should be cautious. Too many older people felt safe by wearing a mask, even though the mask did not protect them at all.
And that is the last of the 10 items in the document. It's a review of masking. And again, there are a great many hyperlinks in here so that people can click and read what has actually been concluded about the effectiveness or otherwise of masks. And again, I've admitted this in the past, early on, because, you know, what do I know about this? This is not my field at all. It's not even remotely my field. So early on, I thought, well, maybe for a while, mask wearing will help get us out of this. Now, I thought that, right? And I don't like the wearing of masks, period, because of the social effect. You can't have a society with people running around looking like ducks because they have a duck bill on their face and I can't see how they're responding to me. And this is not normal. And you cannot have a society like that without the unspoken nonverbal cues that you get from, I mean, I can't even believe I'm sitting here having to explain the value of full, unhindered human communication, but we need that. But I do think there were some people who at the beginning believed it, but continued to believe it. I mean, I looked at the results and I looked at all these countries where they were all masked up and they didn't seem to do any good. And people might say, oh, but there were many factors at work. But if masks were as effective as we were told, then that effect should have shown up in the data. And as I showed early on, using some of Ian Miller's charts, if you look at the European countries, you look at everywhere from, you know, you look at Austria, France, Spain, the UK, the Czech Republic, all these places, and you look at their charts, let's say, of COVID mortality over time, you cannot, based on that chart, even remotely guess where their mask mandate went into effect. Maybe you would think it was at the peak, and then the mask mandate, and then the numbers fell. But actually, when you try to pinpoint the mask mandate in these various places, it's completely random where it is on the COVID chart. It's completely random. And it shouldn't be. If it were a major, major intervention that would make a real difference, it should poke out somewhere in the results. And yet it didn't. And that's what made me change my mind.
Yeah, and that's good that you have an open-minded set to sort of look at the data and revise your views. In terms of masks, when the pandemic started, we obviously did not have any studies on masks on COVID, but we had studies on masks on influenza and other infectious diseases. And those were the good studies, the randomized trials. And those had been generally been negative, showing that the mask does not provide much protection for transmission of these viruses. So it was kind of far-fetched to believe that it would work for COVID. But I guess to be sure, you have to do a randomized trial on COVID. And there was two studies, one from Denmark. It was called the Danmask study, and showed that wearing a mask did not reduce your risk of getting COVID. It was a null result, which means that either there's no effect or it could be a tiny positive or tiny negative effect. And then there was the other study in Bangladesh where they randomized all villages to either wear masks or not. And they found that masks reduced infection by between 0 and 18%. So either there was no benefit or very small benefit. And an intervention that reduces infection by 18%, like a vaccine, you would never, there would be a failed vaccine if it was a vaccine. You want something in the 90s, preferably. So the two good randomized studies that evaluated masks both found zero or minimal efficacy of masks for COVID. But then CDC was pushing other studies, and the newspaper, the New York Times, they were pushing other studies that were terrible, trying to prove that mask works. So for example, there was this study out of Duke University in North Carolina. It's mentioned in the report that we wrote that New York Times were propagating. And it was a study where the kids in North Carolina were wearing masks, but there was a mask mandate in the schools. And then they looked, well, there was very little transmission of COVID among the kids. So then they concluded that it must be because of the masks. And that was written in the New York Times. Now, these kids were also wearing shoes, all of them. So it could equally well be the wearing of the shoes that kept the transmission of COVID down, or the fact that they mostly of them brushed their teeth in the morning or whatever. So it was a completely nonsensical study to try to conclude that. And of course, we know from other studies in Iceland that children generally transmitted very, very limitedly. So it was a completely ridiculous study that was then propagated in New York Times. So I don't know why they do those things, but I think they were desperate to find something to prove what they wanted to prove.
Is it a definite that there will be some kind of COVID commission? I haven't followed this.
So we don't know if there'll be a COVID commission in the U.S. I hope so, but we don't know. There are, of course, we know there will be COVID hearings. So there's actually one going on right now in the House, in the Energy and Commerce Committee, a subcommittee on health. So that's going on right now. And there are on the witness stand, there's the CDC director, NIH director, and the FDA director. So hopefully they will be asked some of these questions, because there are certainly many, many questions that we should ask them.
Have you sent this document to, let's say, friendly politicians?
We have sent it to some politicians in the Congress, yes. And of course, it's also public, so anybody can download it or read it.
Well, it is very much worth reading. Now, there will be people who listen to my show and other shows who won't like this or that section of it. But by and large, these are the questions that need to be asked. So you can check the whole thing out once again at norfolkgroup.org. That's N-O-R-F-O-L-K group.org. I haven't actually gone there yet. As I say, I have the PDF. I'm going to go check that out. This is one of these cases, Martin, where if you didn't do this, nobody was going to do it. There are many situations in life in which you think, well, maybe I could write a book on X, but somebody else is obviously going to write a book on X. But during COVID, if you hadn't spoken up, it's not like there was a big army of people ready to go. You knew, because of the moral obligation you felt you had, that you had to say something. And so likewise here, if you guys don't produce this thing, nobody else is going to do it. Because as you say in the document, so many people are afraid of offending the powerful. And so, you know, you have tenure, might as well, I assume you have tenure, might as well use it.
Well, I think with this document, I think many of the questions are questions that regular people are asking.
Yes.
But I think it's actually good to have the group of us of eight public health scientists who are writing down the questions. So I think there's a purpose of that. But a lot of regular people have been asking these questions for a long time. So it's, in that sense, it's not sort of novel, but it helps, I think, when the public health scientists are asking these questions.
Right, right, right. Well, I urge people to check out norfolkgroup.org. I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/2280. I would love to get the answers to these questions, but I will take, as a runner-up option, I will accept seeing them squirm while trying to avoid giving the answer. I will accept that too, because some of these questions have their own answers embedded within them. And so just seeing them squirm would also make me happy, but I would love to see them genuinely try to wrestle with them. And I hope people will spread the word about what you produced here. So thanks so much, Martin. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom. Great pleasure talking to you.
All right, folks, before we wrap up for today, I want to remind you of something that Gene Epstein mentioned a few episodes ago, and that is the next debate at the Soho Forum. So if you are in the New York City area, if it's easy for you to get there, then I highly recommend you attend their debate. With the resolution, the breakup of the United States into different regions is a workable option likely to bring a marked improvement in human affairs. And our friend Ryan McMakin, whom you will know from the Tom Woods Show, I hope, and also from the Mises Institute, will be arguing for the affirmative in this debate against Jonathan Casey. So I think it's going to be very, very much worth your while. And if you can't make it, then you can also watch the live stream. And in so doing, you will be supporting the Soho Forum, which does really, really important work. So get the details on that. And by the way, this is not an ad. Gene doesn't pay for this, but Gene's a good guy doing really good work under very challenging conditions, and I want to help him. And I love going to these debates when I can. So I'm not recommending anything to you that I wouldn't do myself. I love the Soho Forum. I absolutely love it. So check it out, thesohoforum.org, where you can find out how to get tickets to attend or to watch the live stream. So check that out, thesohoforum.org. I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.